Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Former Newfoundland and Labrador Premier Brian Peckford wrote a blog piece in which he combines the news stories of the StatsCan deep dive into confidential banking information on Canadians and Adrian Clarkson, the former Governor General's deep dive into the public money trough. I spoke with the former Newfoundland Premier about that. She was known as Jane Doe, but her real name is Judy Munro Leighton, and she very publicly accused Justice Brett Kavanaugh of raping her in the backseat of a car, as congressional hearings into Kavanaugh's inclusion on the Supreme Court of the United States were being held. She now admits that she lied because she was trying to stop Kavanaugh from making it to the court. I spoke with Ari Goldkind, Toronto criminal lawyer and media commentator. British Columbia is engaged in a multi-week referendum on which voting methodology the province's electorate should use in upcoming provincial elections. Voters are being asked two questions, and I asked Richard Zussman about that, Global News reporter for the BC Legislature. As the migrant caravan from Central America makes its way to the Mexico-US border, President Trump is deploying the American military to stop the caravan. How does a former senior U.S. military commander see this? Colonel Peter Mansour, former executive officer for General David Petraeus in Iraq, joined us. The American midterm election, less than 48 hours away. What are the expectations? What are the possibilities as far as the decision of the electorate is concerned? The decision by Statistics Canada to start scooping up personal financial data on Canadians might not break the law here, but one expert says the demands it is forcing on Canadian private sector businesses could end up jeopardizing their trade opportunities in Europe. In an interview with the West Bloc's Mercedes Stevenson, Scott Smith, a privacy expert with the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, warned businesses are concerned that the requirement to hand over consumer data to the Federal Statistics Agency will highlight the differences between Canadian privacy laws and a tough new law in Europe and put trade at risk. Quote, we're concerned about adequacy, and adequacy simply means the legislation in Canada is substantially similar to that in Europe. So the decision allows businesses here to continue doing business with European companies under a new privacy regulation there, but the public sector is not subject to PIPEDA, a major concern that has been raised repeatedly in recent years by the Federal Privacy Commissioner. The problem is our public sector privacy laws are not substantially similar, and by amplifying this element of the distinction, it may threaten that future relationship, Smith said. In other words, no, those are the words, that our trade relationship, our deals with the European companies could be hampered, damaged, stopped by this innocuous little plan that StatsCan has, without, of course, the engagement of the federal government from the beginning, right, tongue in cheek, can be damaging. This is just so wrong. Brian Peckford is the former Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador. We spoke with the Premier a few weeks ago about the notwithstanding clause and how that was so necessary to be part of the charter, and because he was part of the negotiations. If that hadn't happened, there wouldn't have been the repatriation of the Constitution. Premier Peckford, thank you very much for taking the time today. So you're not really exactly enthusiastic about this StatsCan compilation of your, my, all of our listeners' private information, which they, of course, say is only there to provide them with an idea, a sense of what we do routinely so they have a good idea of where we go on vacation and, you know, what restaurants we use.
Yeah, this is unbelievable to me. As I said on my blog, it's shocking. I just don't know where our country, where society is going this in these times. A few weeks ago, as you said, we talked about the notwithstanding clause. There's also another clause in that constitution, the charter, which we approved. And by the way, Roy, we were right in that interview back then, just a few weeks ago. The court did rule along the lines that you and I talked about and vindicated what we were saying on your program. Now today we have a Section 7, you know, in the Charter, which talks about protecting the liberty and security of the person in Section 7. I would argue that this StatsCan power given under legislation in the House of Commons to allow StatsCan to commandeer, if you will, the banks into providing information on individuals' banking habits, all the way to, by the way, according to Amanda Colony, all the way to their social insurance numbers, violates that provision of the Constitution. We thought our liberty and our security of the person was protected through Section 7. And so, therefore, fundamentally, I think we have a problem with personal liberty and to what extent a federal government of Canada can coerce in violation of that charter. And so I think it's incumbent upon the opposition parties in the House of Commons and other leaders in the country to challenge this at its fundamental level, not at the business of a little privacy here and no privacy there, but fundamentally to determine whether, in fact, the people of Canada are protected in the privacy of their banking activity from the federal government, and that the only exception could be in terms of whether the information was necessary for terrorism or for some capital crime or something, that some exceptions could be made. But otherwise, the normal functioning of an individual's transaction with its own bank should be protected.
Didn't it seem to you to be rather cavalier, the manner in which the Prime Minister dealt with it? We played the clip a couple of minutes ago, where he just almost casually, and he was reading, he wasn't speaking extemporaneously, he was reading, but it just seemed he so casually dismissed any concerns that you might have, that I might have, that our listeners may have, that people across Canada may have, that there's nothing to worry about here, there's nothing to see here, move along.
I think that's what struck a lot of people, besides the content and substance of what StatsCan is saying. The other thing is, if you read a paragraph that StatsCan put out talking about, it's becoming increasingly difficult to capture household expenditures by relying on traditional surveys. That tells it all. My, oh my, StatsCan, you're having some problems by asking Canadians to give you some information. So now that you're having some problems by asking the Canadians themselves whether they can have some of their information, you're going to now, because it's getting increasingly difficult, go behind their backs and do it through commandeering the banks. Now, that tells you all one needs to know.
In all of the emails that I've received, and I've received many over the last week, because we first spoke with David Aiken, chief political correspondent for Global News, who broke the story. Last weekend, we spoke with David. Since then, I've received a significant number of emails from people across the country. And they all, virtually all, I shouldn't say all, but they all, virtually all, raise the point somewhere in the email that perhaps the government is actually not doing this randomly, that there are people, that there are Canadians of particular interest to the federal government, and those Canadians of particular interest will be certainly among those whose information is being culled. What do you say?
One has to, and you know, given that you got so many emails making that point, shows you that Canadians are getting very, very suspicious of the actions of our governments. And this just points it out in spades. But fundamentally, our personal liberty is being jeopardized by actions like this by agencies of the federal government. You know, in my blog, I quoted Friedrich Hayek, whose book I'm just rereading, The Constitution of Liberty. And he talks about that. This is a book in 1960. Mr. Hayek, of course, won the Nobel Prize for Economics as well. Austrian economist who taught at Columbia University for many years. And his books have become classics in their field. and this one on the Constitution of Liberty is sort of a classic of the 20th century on defining and describing personal liberty and how, over time, governments who were supposed to be limited to do certain activities have expanded their role in society to the point where personal liberty means very little. And he talked about the day that would come, like George Orwell did. He talked about the day that would come if there wasn't a lot of vigilant citizens around when these kinds of things would occur, and they're done subtly and therefore are easily disbanded with by a prime minister or by a minister or by the agency itself. We're just getting tough doing it the normal way, so now we got to do it the abnormal way. So this was all signaled, and we are at that point right now. And so a national conversation needs to be held, and the opposition parties need to be held account of as well as the government, because they should stop and ask the question, you know, is this a fundamental weakness now of our society? Have we evolved this far where agencies of the government can come in without our consent and look at our privacy transactions?
I think the opposition parties are really election opportunists at this point.
Yes.
Between now and the 21st of October of next year, they're going to ruffle no feathers that could cost them even one vote. If an advisor says, this is too tricky, don't go near it, they won't go near it.
Yes.
And Premier, when you talk about having a national conversation, that being necessary, I fundamentally agree. I also saw yesterday, just going through some of my notes, I keep a lot of things, so that later on, when everybody else has forgotten them,
yes,
I can remind folks.
Yes.
I found last year there was a study done in the United States, a survey done of Americans, and a majority of Americans, and freedom of speech was just such a valued cornerstone in the United States, a majority, yes, of Americans feel they can no longer exercise their freedom of speech, certainly when it comes to challenging governments, because,
right,
they'll be shouted down. And so they're intimidated to the point,
right,
they just don't do it anymore. And when our freedom of expression is so compromised, we have a serious problem.
You know what? You're dead right, because in my ordinary day-to-day activities, I encounter people. I bike every day, and I got a certain loop here in Nanaimo where I bike every day, and I go in for coffee here and there, and I'm a part of a couple of coffee groups and one thing and another. But I innocently, and most times people don't know who you know, my past, and I just ask some, you know, sort of basic questions. Did you hear this on television, or did you read this in the paper, or whatever? And I have been absolutely shocked over the last year, especially the last year, because I've kept track of it, how many Canadians are afraid to even talk to me about it sitting down in, mm-hmm, a coffee shop, because, mm-hmm, they look to their right and to their left to see if anybody can hear.
Yeah,
them.
I've seen that too.
My voice is sort of loud, and they really, really don't want me to engage in that kind of conversation.
You wrote about the former Governor General, Adrian Clarkson. We just found out that the former GG has been billing us over $100,000 a year, or around $100,000 a year, since she left office in 2005. And she wrote a piece a couple of days ago in which she justifies what she did and says she gets lots of requests to speak and appear at various functions, many of which she doesn't get paid for, and just makes the case that she's remained in public life and she's essentially entitled to her entitlements. What do you say? Remember,
I mean,
that line, don't you?
Enough of 1 week to have StatsCan coming out and trying to, you know, publicly justify the unjustifiable. Now we've got the entitlement princess or queen trying to entitle her entitlements. I mean, you know, in 1 week, this is heavy. This is heavy stuff, and it's hard to assimilate all of this. I mean, there are lots of former prime ministers. I mean, Mr. Mulroney, Mr. Chrétien, Mr. Martin, who are around. There are lots of former ministers who served a lot longer in the House of Commons and in formal public service than Adrian Clarkson ever did. Hers is 6 years, and she's gotten $5.7 million plus, because we don't know how much of that $7 million for her foundation the government was able to match with the private sector. We do know for sure she's gotten $5.7 million since 2005. Pension and her expenses paid, like you said, almost over $100,000 a year every year, plus a $3 million startup for her foundation.
Not all bad.
I mean, this is the ultimate in entitlement I've ever seen. I mean, any child or any teenager or college student reading this, I mean, talk about an entitlement society, they are totally within their bounds now to say, I am entitled as a person of this community to free this, free that, free something else, because the Governor General of this country has been doing it since 2005.
I'll never forget 1999, her first year as Governor General. She flew out to Alberta from Ottawa on a Challenger jet. And she was there for a number of days at functions in Calgary and then Edmonton. When she left Calgary, the Challenger was no longer available. It had been moved to do other business. So she flew to Edmonton on a Dash 8 prop helicopter, prop plane, about 42 seats, right? You know them. So that was okay. But when it was suggested to the Governor General that she might have to fly back to Ottawa on the Dash 8, that was not good. That was not acceptable. So what they did was, at a cost of $61,000 to the taxpayer, they flew out another Challenger to Calgary, or Edmonton rather, to pick her up and fly her back to Ottawa with her husband, John Ralston Saul, because she was, no way she was flying from Edmonton on a Dash 8. She was having the Challenger, and she got it.
Yeah, well, that just shows you, the type of behavior pattern that we're dealing with here.
Premier, I know you...
I don't know who advised her, but, she obviously has very poor PR advisors to get her to write this article.
Can you stay with us a little bit longer?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because I have to take a break. I want to talk to you some more.
Statistics Canada will use anonymized data for statistical purposes only. No personal information will be made public. Statistics Canada is engaged with the Privacy Commissioner's Office on this project and is working with them to ensure Canadians' banking information remains protected and private.
Did you hear that? Did you focus on the same words I focused on? A certain amount of transparency? Canadians expect a certain amount of transparency from individuals who've served as the vice-regal of Canada. They've stepped up and they served Canada. Well, yeah, they stepped up and they served Canada, and they've been handsomely rewarded for that, and they continue to be handsomely rewarded for that until the day they die. But the Prime Minister, I guess it doesn't matter who the Prime Minister is. In this case, we have Mr. Trudeau. But if it were another Prime Minister with another situation, a year out from an election, I don't think they'd be saying very much different.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. What really disturbs me, Adrian Clarkson comes out with this letter. The Prime Minister is saying, a little bit, we'll get a little bit of transparency. In her letter trying to justify, or her column or her article trying to justify it, she doesn't make one mention of $1. She doesn't make one disclosure of anything she did. She just gives numbers that she's compiled or her staff has compiled. This is the little bit of transparency. I'm insulted as a Canadian. I'm insulted as a citizen. I'm insulted as a taxpayer to have to read this pablum from the former GG who has gotten $5.7 million out of the taxpayers since she left office and is going to get her expenses paid until she dies, in addition to her pension and in addition to money from the government for her foundation. So if the Prime Minister is talking about getting some accountability and transparency into how former GGs are paid, he better start by having Ms. Clarkson withdraw that article and bring out another one giving complete details of everything she did to justify the money she got from us.
In, I think it was 2004, that she conducted the tour, the Circumpolar Tour.
Yes, I remember that one.
Right? The tour of, was it Finland, Iceland, yes. Ukraine, Russia? And it was supposed to cost us $1 million, which was outlandish anyway. But then it ended up costing us $5 million.
Exactly.
And she had an entourage of self-important people who were on this Circumpolar Tour. And when she was asked about the cost and about the money, the response from her office was that the Governor General is above politics.
Yeah.
I wish I could answer that way.
I wish I could, too. I wish I could, too. But, somehow, there's got to be some more accountability into this system. And it's just not enough for the Prime Minister to say what he said. What they should have been doing already, they've had a few days now, is actually releasing all of the data. What's wrong with releasing the data that we've paid for?
What a novel idea. What a novel idea, Premier. Yep, I agree. Absolutely. And I would imagine that close to 100% of our listeners are nodding their heads now, are saying, yeah, right on.
Yeah, well, what's the big deal? If you're saying you're going to be transparent, well, be transparent. And do it. The other thing, of course, his minister could be doing. I know, because I was there. It's easy to do. He could have an amendment already in place to go to the House of Commons with, or a new piece of legislation, whichever you want, or amending the existing one, which allows for this to happen, and amend it to say that for the first 2 years or whatever after they leave office, they will be provided with expense money based upon a scrutiny of the bills that come in to ensure that what was done was in for the nation as a whole or for national unity or whatever for 2 years. And then after that, they're the same as everybody else. So he could do that tomorrow.
But here's the aha moment on as far as that's concerned. If they did what you're suggesting, and I think it would behoove them to do that, then the next question that would come from Brian Peckford or Roy Green or any number of people in this country would be, well, let's have a look at some of the other expenses we're not privy to.
I agree.
And my good friend Michelle Simpson, who was a Liberal Member of Parliament and was Justin Trudeau's seatmate when they were in opposition, Michelle started to post all of her expenses online, as our listeners know, and she was immediately called into the office of Michael Ignatieff, who at the time was the Liberal Party leader,
yep.
And she was dressed down, and she was told she shouldn't do that, she mustn't do that.
Yep.
She refused to comply,
yep.
And so they took away her privileges to speak in Parliament, which meant she could not even acknowledge the death of a 21-year-old constituent in Afghanistan who was a member of the Canadian Armed Forces.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and she was then offered a bribe. They offered her a big office with its own bathroom.
Yep.
When she turned them down, they absolutely just dispatched her to the gulag. So if they provided us with the information on the expenses, as you would like them to, then we would start asking about the other expenses, and that would be uncomfortable. Premier, there's something else I want to mention to you in our closing minutes here, and
okay.
The Canadian border. Has been a huge issue for the last number of years. And the fact that it's as porous as it is a major concern, not to the sitting government, but certainly to a significant number of Canadians. So I came across a story that I'd filed away last year. And again, it's a global news story, excuse me, of the summer of last year, anticipating that by the end of 2021, processing the expected number of refugee claimants or claims, that would be 192,700. That's the expectation. That by the time the year 2021 ends, there'll be 192,700 individuals whose refugee claims will be in the hopper, as it were, being processed. With the support cost for each claimant at $600 per month, that would tally some $2.97 billion. And result in wait times of approximately 11 years. And this is an estimate from the IRB.
Yeah. It's just amazing. When you said that they'll have to wait 11 years to get processed or whether they can stay in Canada or not, it reminded me of the Governor General's millions of dollars of expenses and all the rest of it since 2005 when in my own personal life we had to wait a year and a half to almost 2 years for a medical procedure and could wait no longer and had to go pay for it in order to ensure that we were safe. So now we talk about wait times for refugees
11 years.
Being 11 years so that they can be in the country. We don't know whether they should be here or not.
And often we don't know where they are.
Well, precisely. They just go into the woodwork. But, I mean, that's an amazing figure. I would love to see that author of that piece update that now this year. 192,000 does sound realistic. And I know the $600 figure is quite reasonable. Suddenly we're getting into the billions of dollars to process people that we don't know are even eligible to be here.
192,700 by the end of the year 2021.
Yes, yes.
And we might as well say $3 billion.
Yeah.
That's 2.97. And this is from the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada. They can't keep up.
Wow.
And so what happens? We don't know where the people are.
Yes.
The government is pounding out the money, and we're told, don't worry, be happy, everything's fine.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I have, talking about the Governor General and doing things, we all have, as former politicians, helped out in the community. One of the ways in which it just came to my lot to help out was usually I get people who come to me after they've exhausted the process, and somebody says to them, oh, you live sure where Mr. Peckford lives. Why don't you just give him a call? And so I've had to, I have dealt with a whole bunch of cases where the system, both provincially and federally, has failed these people miserably, whereby they've exhausted all their private savings and end up then in an awful situation. And in one particular case on the medical side, I actually was able to get a thing reversed, which had cost these people all their savings, and they were down to now just their Canada pension to live off of, and they were quite comfortable people when the 5 years before that they had started to get involved in this thing because they had one of the couples had a medical condition. So it's really difficult for me because having been there and then later, since I got out a long time ago, dealing with individuals on a daily basis who have these kinds of problems with the governments, and then you hear about these refugees, then you hear about the Governor General, then you hear about StatsCan. This is why I started my blog, because I became so frustrated, and I needed an outlet to express this, and hopefully some people will read it and see that it's something that they agree with too.
Well, I can certainly say to my listeners across Canada, you want to make it a regular occurrence to go to peckford42@wordpress.com, peckford42@wordpress.com. Premier Brian Peckford, the former Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador. Premier, thank you so much for the time, and thanks for still standing up for the folks who need your help.
Thank you very much, Roy. It's really good talking to you.
We'll talk to you again.
Right there.
Bye-bye. Brian Peckford. Harry Goldkind joins us, Toronto criminal lawyer and media commentator. And thank you, Ari, for taking the time. And first of all, what's your reaction to what took place? And then can you put it into a legal perspective for us, please?
Sure. Good to be on with you, Roy. First of all, I think just to go back to the intro, everything is political and everybody chooses a side now. There are people that even disagree that the sun rises in the east, and that's become political. So that's the day and age we live in, thanks to what I call anti-social media, which is otherwise known as Twitter, which polarizes everybody because that's the world we live in. In terms of Brett Kavanaugh, you know, I thought that the hearings were a bit of a circus. I can tell you that I thought he was massively unfairly treated. I think it's very interesting that as much as President Trump is very, very open and liable to be criticized for a million different things and a million different lies, which he sort of can tell the way you and I eat breakfast easily, on this issue, he is absolutely right. And in my view, it should be as nonpartisan that he is right about this issue with Judge Kavanaugh and his fake accusers as he is wrong about so much else that he is called out on. And from a legal point of view, which you asked me about, two very simple things, Roy. One, I believe, and I've said this openly throughout every discussion I have about the U.S. Supreme Court, that nobody on either side should have any respect whatsoever for the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court is a joke in and of itself. It is a partisan hackery kind of court that, as all of your listeners will know, the decisions are as predictable as the day is long. They are based on who appointed you and what your politics are. They have no basis in law. And given that we're in Canada, Roy, that's something that our Supreme Court should be much more proud of. People should be much more proud of our Supreme Court. So I just think in the context where the court itself is a joke, the partisan rancor over the Kavanaugh hearings and the sky is falling and all this stuff is also a joke, because that Supreme Court is a political body, not a legal one. And Roy, I'll end with this. In this day and age, that's even more dangerous, where the rule of law that people say Trump is ruining is one that the U.S. Supreme Court has never even stood for.
You know, one of the things that I said as these hearings were going forward were that this is not about justice. The Supreme Court is supposed to be about justice, about the ultimate backstop as far as the law is concerned, the Constitution is concerned, the way, the proper way to do things according to legislation and history and all the rest of it. But it's not. It's about politics. It's about winning another political battle and having a justice on the court who is going to be at least fundamentally in agreement with the political party that put him or her there. And I'm just echoing what you said. But at the same time, I have some concerns about our court. I just have concerns about just blanket appointments. I'm not suggesting that Supreme Court judges should be elected. I don't want to see the kind of circus that we see in the United States with the congressional hearings. But I'm not comfortable, Ari, with the prime minister and the selection committee going ahead and making an appointment the way they're doing it now. There have been too many cases where appointments have just backfired. Not talking about the Supreme Court necessarily, just appointments are concerning.
Well, let's look at the Supreme Court for the first few seconds of my answer, and let's move down towards the provinces and their courts. The one thing about the Supreme Court of Canada is, first of all, you're quite right that whoever's in power of the day gets to appoint the Supreme Court judge. I mean, that some people would say is very akin to the U.S. It's actually not, because across our history and across different parties, and this may be a little wonky, but I think it's kind of interesting, political parties that are the prime minister of the day, for example, they might appoint people that are somewhat sympathetic to a certain cause, but they'll also appoint people that have a record of nonpartisan legal scholarship. And that is very, very different than the U.S. And as we move down, let's leave Ottawa for a minute. Let's go to every province and how those appointments are done. I've always raised an eyebrow about that. Many appointments are very much who you know, what organization you belong to. Do you give the right speeches to the right advocate society? There's a lot of secrets about that. But first of all, you have to have 10 years of experience to be an appointed judge. And I can tell you, although there are obviously sometimes flies in the ointment, Roy, we have a really decent system of appointing judges that when I and many other lawyers see most judges getting appointed, because we get a legal bulletin, for example, that very few people read besides us lawyers, very rarely, it does happen, but very rarely do we roll our eyes and say, that's a garbage appointment that makes no sense. The way if you drive through the U.S. in election season, you'll see all these election signs for judges that say, I'm tough on crime. I'll hang people. I'm a member of the NRA, so I'll be a good judge. Some people may prefer that, Roy. I don't.
Yeah, you make a persuasive argument. I still like at the lower court level that I like the idea of electing judges. I'm going to have to be persuaded that that's not the right way to go, but I will say you do make a persuasive argument. Now, what's going to be the fallout? What do you see the actual fallout of this admission by this Judy Munro Leighton to be? What's going to happen to her? And what's the impact going to be, if there's going to be any, in a broader sense as far as, you know, judicial appointments are concerned?
I can tell you two things. First of all, I would discuss the issue of elected lower court judges or not, and I would just say in 10 seconds, not that that's your question. We need to be very careful about what the role of the judiciary is. Is the judiciary there to put a rubber stamp on the popular views of the day, or is the judiciary there to sort of act as a check on the popular views of the day? If it's by election, you can finish my thought for me. If it's by rubber stamp, you can also finish my thought for me. Let me move to your question about the impact. It's very interesting, Roy, and I actually think this is such an interesting subject. I could talk about this all day. The Me Too movement, the U.S. hearings, this lady who's a complete and abject liar, who in any normal universe, or if she was lying on the other side, she would probably be charged with perjury. Here, she'll probably be viewed as a martyr. She'll get a get-out-of-jail-free card. The good news arising out of this is that The Economist, and again, I'm going to get a little wonky, Roy, but I find this stuff very interesting. There are a lot of studies. The latest one is in The Economist, a well-reputed magazine. We're not talking the National Enquirer. Has started measuring the views of people to Me Too and the complaints coming forward. And there becomes now a growing concern, and I'm going to make the more interesting point in just 10 seconds, there becomes a growing concern now about people being falsely accused and how an allegation now has been substituted for proof. And anything in our society that puts a check on the Me Too movement, which I think in many ways, Roy, has been an insult of the highest order to women who have been genuinely sexually assaulted, genuinely raped, genuinely fired from jobs because they would not put out from their boss. And we have all of these complaints now that are either inaccurate, spurious, disingenuous. What's interesting in this study, and I mentioned I would tell you the part that's interesting to me, is we do not see a divide between the genders on Me Too. You would think it would be women versus men in all of these studies and studying the numbers. It is not. Women and men tend to look at these movements very similar. There is not a battle of the sexes. There is a battle, and this is what the data tells us, between left and right, between those who support Trump and Clinton. That is dangerous, but what would be more dangerous would be a battle of the sexes. And I think it's very interesting that when you have this woman coming forward and being shown to be an abject liar, it wakes many people up to the idea that we should still, and it's a little bit anachronistic, I mean, we're talking something that a lot of people don't believe in anymore, an allegation is simply not proof. Human beings, whether they're men or whether they're women, are capable of lies, and we need to remember that.
Good points all. I'd be more happy or more comfortable with appointed courts if governments didn't hand off decision-making to the courts with such frequency, with such regularity, and with such ease, because it's easier for them to say, well, the court said, so there it is.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I wrote an op-ed in the Toronto Star about that a month, 2 months ago that got a lot of response about just how much, as you just said, and I will parrot what you said, politicians duck their responsibility because they don't want to be overturned because they know some group will take them to court and very liberal left-wing judges will likely support them.
Ari, always good talking to you. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Roy.
Ari Goldklein from Toronto. So British Columbians are involved in a referendum right now, a lengthy one, to decide how in upcoming provincial elections they're going to vote, and voters are being asked two questions. Richard Justman is Global News BC provincial legislator reporter, and he joins us on the Roy Green Show on the Chorus Radio Network. Richard, thank you for the time. And first of all, what's at stake?
Yeah, Roy, what's at stake is, as you mentioned, the way that British Columbians vote going forward. It's a referendum, mail-in. People have until the end of November to send back their ballots. British Columbians now, most of them have their ballots if they were already registered. And so what people are trying to decide is, do they want to stay with first past the post, which is the electoral system we have in all the provinces in Canada and federally as well, or does British Columbia want to switch to proportional representation, a proportional system where the number of seats you have is more reflective on the number of votes you get province-wide in this case.
Fair bit of passion?
Yeah, for sure. You know what it's like whenever there's a referendum about issues. There are sides on, there are people on both sides who are very passionate about it, but it's funny. It's not one of those things you hear a lot about in the coffee shops or if you go out for dinner with friends. You know, this referendum has been a little bit silent in terms of really firing up everyday people. But there are people on both sides of this argument who are mainly those advocating for that really want to see a change. But it's not one of those issues. You know, we had a referendum here around the HST in 2011.
I remember it well.
The provincial government brought in the tax, and it was hugely controversial. And you could feel it then. You know, whenever you went, people were talking about how they were going to vote and what they thought of the tax. And that was a big citizens' movement. How that led out of people being so angry about the tax that they triggered, basically forced the provincial government to call a referendum. It was a much different feeling then than it is now about changing the electoral system.
Now, the referendum system in British Columbia is different to anywhere else in the country. You have the option and the opportunity to call referenda. Can you explain to us just briefly how that works?
Yeah, so how it worked with the HST is in every riding in the province, you needed to get a certain number of registered voters to basically sign up saying they wanted to see a referendum. It's non-binding in the legislature, but it would be foolish for a premier ever to turn down one of those. So what happened is there was a big advocacy campaign, and the team that wanted the referendum on the HST to get rid of it was able to get enough signatures to basically force the premier to call a referendum. This referendum is very, very different. This was one that was negotiated behind the scenes between the NDP and the Greens during the power-sharing discussion. So, you know, as I'm sure most of the listeners know, we had an incredible election last year in British Columbia where the Liberals ended up with the most seats, but not enough to form a majority, and there were negotiations with the Greens between the NDP and the Liberals, and they ended up picking the NDP. And part of that negotiation was that there was going to be a referendum in British Columbia on electoral reform. So that's how we got to this referendum, but there is an option for citizen-led referendums, which is what we saw with the HST.
Yeah, I like that idea. If you have enough people in any constituency who want a referendum, and then you add up all of the people or all the constituencies and you come up with a majority, it's kind of hard for the premier, as you said, the premier of the day, to not go ahead with it, because that would be like political suicide, which some of them, frankly, are quite good at. Now, when it comes to political support for a position or another position, either the first past the post or the proportional representation, I imagine that, I don't, it's not like I don't do any reading, okay? But you've got the NDP and the Greens like the proportional side of things, right?
Yes, they do.
Who's on the other side, the Liberals?
The Liberals are. So, you know, as listeners know, here in British Columbia, the political parties work a little bit differently than many other places in the country. There is no strong conservative party provincially. The BC Liberals are, as they describe themselves, the Free Enterprise Party. So, you know, federal conservatives are members of the BC Liberals, and some federal Liberals also support the BC Liberals, but many federal Liberals also support the NDP provincially. So it's a little bit different here, but the BC Liberals are advocating strongly to keep first past the post. You know, they talk about the stability of the system and that it has done us well for a long, long time. Coming up this week on Thursday, we have a debate that will be on global television and then CKNW as well, between Liberal leader Andrew Wilkinson and BC Premier John Horgan about this issue. So they'll go 30 minutes debating proportional representation and first past the post, and then at that point, voters will get sort of a better sense of, you know, why the political parties have decided to stand on each side of this debate.
Okay, Richard, why is this a multi-week referendum?
Yeah, so part of it is it's a mail-in ballot. So, you know, BC is a big, big province. It takes time for the ballots to get to people's homes and back. It also gives people time to, you know, research the issue. Many people now have the ballots in front of them. It's top of mind. They can watch this debate, listen to the debate, read about the issues, and then get their ballot back. You know, you have to have it back by the end of the month, so that means you need to have it a few days before that in the mail, or you can drop it off at one of 60 service stations here in BC. But I think part of it is that there's legislative mandates in terms of how long the period can last, very similar to an election period, and it gives people time to sort of get to know the issues and then make an informed vote.
So what happens after it's over? You've done your voting, the numbers have all been tallied, we know what the majority of the British Columbians want. What happens then? Is that now binding on the government, or is it, again, we'll take it under advisement, we'll take it under consideration?
It's binding, Roy, but there's a lot of ifs, and that's one of the really fascinating things about this referendum. So once the ballots are counted, all one side needs is 50% plus one. There are no thresholds in terms of the number of people who have to vote, so we could have a very low voter turnout, and still, if just 50% plus one of the ballots returned or for a certain system, that's where we go. But it can only be in place for elections after July 1st, 2021. So if, because we're in a minority government situation here, we end up with a provincial election before that date, even if people in the referendum voted for proportional representation, the next election would be fought under the first-past-the-post system. And it's still unclear, because depending on what happens in that election, potentially a new government could, you know, scrap the results of the referendum. So that part is tricky. And then the other part, if we do change your proportional system, British Columbians are voting on three potential types of proportional representation. Two of them have never been tested anywhere else in the world. They are made in BC approaches to proportional representation. So a lot has to be done after the vote in terms of drawing up electoral boundaries, figuring out how many MLAs will be in each region, determining what areas are urban compared to rural, compared to semi-urban. So there's a lot of work that has to be done after the referendum to figure out exactly how it will look the next time British Columbians vote.
Wow. I prefer the first past the post, but I can see the value of having a really significantly important and people-driven approach to how the election should be held, as opposed to having some backroom politicians make the decisions and then lower the whatever the decision is on the electorate. But given the fact that if there's an election prior to 2021, you say, the first past the post system is going to remain in place, I would imagine then that John Horgan and Andrew Weaver will be holding hands until at least then.
I would expect so, but you know, a lot of things could happen. You know, there are some significant differences between the two of them, and if Premier Horgan started moving towards legislation that the Greens just couldn't stand for, then potentially we could see the government fall apart. But Roy, I think you're right in that sense, that if it passes, we likely will see this go to term, and I've said lots of times I think it's going to end up going to term anyways. Things are pretty stable at this point, but obviously in politics, things can change pretty quickly.
BC, what an interesting place. Several thousand members of the U.S. military now at the border with Mexico. Now, it's going to be some time before the migrants, in fact, arrive. And what happens then, I don't know. Colonel Peter Mansour joins us on the Roy Green Show on the Chorus Radio Network. He is the former executive officer to General David Petraeus and the author of Surge, and which, of course, is the military surge in Iraq, where the Americans did such a great job of creating a cooperative environment with the local population from what had been a really uncooperative reality. Great book. Colonel Mansour, thank you for taking the time. What is your sense of the president's stationing the military at the border at this time and for that purpose?
Well, I think the president is very serious about trying to reduce or stop illegal immigration into the United States. But I think this particular instance where he's pointing out this one caravan of maybe 7,000 individuals moving north through Mexico is timed for the U.S. midterm elections. It plays well to his base, which is concerned about illegal immigration. And he's merely pointing out the fact that it's continuing and he's trying to do something about it.
The immigration issue is, of course, huge in the United States and becoming more so here. Do you share the concerns about who may be involved and who may be included in this caravan?
Actually, I don't. These are people fleeing some very violent countries down in Central America. They just want to get away from the violence and the repression down there. They're moving north. Most of them won't even make it to the U.S. border. And look, you know, we have 7,000 in this one caravan. The U.S. Border Patrol apprehends 36,000 illegal immigrants every month. So this is really a statistical blip more than an invasion.
In Iraq, American troops you commanded were battling a fully insurgent or almost fully insurgent local population. The president has said that rocks will be treated as bullets. Now he's backed away from that somewhat. How does that strike you?
It strikes me, quite frankly, I'm going to use a doctrinal term here, asinine. When I was in Iraq, I actually had kids throw rocks at me and the soldiers I was patrolling with. You know, we chased them off. We didn't fire back. U.S. troops are much more disciplined than to do that. And unless they're faced with deadly violence, they should use deadly violence in return. They always have the right of self-defense, but quite frankly, a rock is not particularly deadly to our well-armed soldiers.
Yeah, this I imagined. I was thinking about this. It cannot play well with frontline troops that they're being sent to the border for this purpose, particularly with people so far away from the American border. They're at least, what, 500-600 miles? And if you're walking that, that's going to take you quite a long time.
Yeah, they won't get here anytime soon. As far as the morale of the troops, you know, I actually commanded an armored cavalry squadron back in 1999 to 2001, and we did routine deployments to the U.S.-Mexican border. We had observation helicopters. We actually conducted military training along the border where we would report crossings, but we wouldn't do anything. We would simply report the information to the U.S. Border Patrol. For that, to us, that was good training for our military mission of conducting reconnaissance. What the Border Patrol did with the information was up to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not so sure that the troops are going to look at this as necessarily a waste of time, but 15,000 troops along an extensive border, it's really not going to do all that much to stop illegal immigration into the United States.
I don't like to engage in what-ifs, but what if the president were to order the troops to take action against the migrants? What do you think? I mean, what's your sense?
If he were to, I'm sorry, you cut out, if he ordered them to shoot migrants?
Well, I mean, he has said that rocks would be treated as bullets, but if he decided the troops had to show some level of force, not, I'm not talking about shooting them, but show some level of force, how would the military respond to that?
I doubt that the commanders would obey those orders. U.S. soldiers, by the Posse Comitatus Act in the United States, cannot apprehend civilians within U.S. borders unless an insurrection has been declared against the U.S. government. That certainly is not the case. They would be violating the law to do that. So I think they would either just ignore the command, or they would push back somehow. I'm sure the commanders would make it clear to the president that what he was suggesting is illegal.
Yeah. Colonel Mansour, if I can just take you back to your book for just a moment, Surge, My Journey with General David Petraeus on the Remaking of the Iraq War. How effective was that surge? I was in a conversation with somebody not long ago about that, and they were making the case that Barack Obama was correct in by pulling American troops out. And my case was, I would say, no, he was not, and I pointed to your book as evidence.
Yeah, well, I would point out to the fact that the surge reduced ethno-sectarian violence in Iraq by more than 90%, which made it possible for the Sunni Arab community to re-engage in the political discourse in that country. In the elections of 2009 and 2010, they voted in greater numbers than any other ethnic community, a sectarian community in Iraq. And I think things were going in the right direction until we disengaged. We were the U.S. military were the glue that was holding the political situation in Iraq together, and certainly that's not a good thing for the long run. But in the short run, we were moving forward and making Iraq politics work, and by disengaging, we lost our leverage with the Iraqi government. It began to act in a very sectarian manner, and things went downhill from there with the rise of ISIS. So I would disagree with the person that was talking to you. I think the surge was a success, and it could have been a longer-term success had we remained.
Yeah. Colonel, thank you so much for the time. It's always good talking to you.
Roy, always a pleasure.
Hours wind down to the midterm election on Tuesday morning. It all begins. The voting begins, at least those who haven't already voted. And from what we understand, the early voting has been very strong. Lots of millions of people going out and voting early. So Tuesday night, we will know what the results are, and whether or not President Trump retains the hold of the House and the Senate, or one or none, and only the White House. Inez de la Cotero joins us, Washington correspondent for Global News. She has been observing and watching this very carefully. Inez, thank you for the time. The early voting numbers are very high, and in a number of states. Is that good news for the Democrats, or does nobody really know?
We don't really know, but they are extremely high. Last I checked, they were at 35 million of early ballots cast. That's more than the 2014 totals. I think it was more than twice the 2014 totals. So what that shows is really that voters are feeling energized on both sides, really. Both Democrats and Republicans seem to be aware of how important this election is, and they're really energized. They really want to get out and vote.
And the youth vote, the numbers of young people who voted early, I understand that's very high.
The youth vote is very high, which was a big concern. There were a lot of efforts, especially on the Democratic side, to get out the youth vote. Many young voters, you know, typically don't vote, especially in the midterms. They don't take the time out of their day. They just don't feel it's as important. So there were a lot of efforts on the Democratic side to get out these millennial voters, first-time voters. A lot of them were especially energized, of course, with everything that happened with Parkland. But also, I think we're seeing just youth voters just paying more attention to everything that's happening in D.C. We're hearing from youth voters a lot that my colleague Jackson Prosco was out in Wisconsin last week talking to young voters, and they were telling him that they're sick of the division and the divisive rhetoric coming out of D.C. So young voters certainly mobilizing. We're seeing women as well getting out there, you know, running for office, but also getting out there and voting. And those two demographics, young voters and women, are expected to be the decisive factors in this election.
So ultimately, what's the election going to be have been fought on? Normally, the key issue that folks focus on is the economy in any election. The economy is doing very well in the United States, so it should be good news for incumbents, but not necessarily, because the president, even though the White House isn't in play, the president's in play. What do you think to the average American voter, what's it going to be about?
Yeah, so there was a new poll out today that was saying that healthcare and the economy are the two biggest issues, the two most important issues for voters right now. The U.S. president certainly talking about the economy on the campaign trail, kind of bragging about how the economy has been doing so well under his leadership, how unemployment is down, and more jobs have been added in recent months. But many Republicans actually are hoping he would actually spend more time talking about the economy, because Trump is also talking a lot about immigration. And what he's really been doing these last few days especially is focusing on stoking fear. And really, he's zeroing in on his base. So he's talking about illegal immigration a lot, the migrant caravan. And that's, many are watching that and saying what he's doing there is trying to stoke his base, trying to get his own voters out to the polls. And it plays well, that kind of rhetoric plays well with his base, calling these migrants criminals and stuff, that plays well with his base, but it's not necessarily going to work well with the maybe more independent voters. So many hoping he would actually spend more time talking about the economy. Democrats, for their part, are talking about healthcare. They're trying to send out a more hopeful message. They're trying to counter Trump's kind of fear-mongering with a hopeful message, talking about uniting the nation. So we saw, Obama, Biden on the campaign trail this week, and that's certainly what they're doing.
So how do things then most fundamentally change if the Democrats win the House and or the Senate? An uncivil war inside the government of the United States increasing in volume, because they're all going to be looking at 2020. The day by Wednesday, they'll all be looking at 2020.
Absolutely. And so the latest forecasts show that the Senate will likely stay Republican, and the House is the one that's really in play. And that is looking increasingly likely to go blue. If that happens, it will be a huge headache for Trump. It'll essentially be gridlock. So the House is the chamber of the U.S. government where bills are introduced. Then they send bills over to the Senate. The Senate kind of approves these bills and then sends them to the president to be signed into law. If the House turns blue, then Democrats will likely vote in a majority to block any Republican bills that are introduced, which means that parts of Trump's agenda just simply won't even make it to the Senate or to Trump's desk. So that is certainly a huge deal. And if the House does go blue, it's going to really just turn into gridlock and become a huge problem for Trump.
Mm-hmm. Or you could end up with what Obama said: I have a pen, I have a phone, and I have whatever else he had. And then you have governing by decree, which we've learned, which we saw in 2016, was overturned very quickly. It's too bad that the days when politicians would argue during the day and then go for a quick bite to eat later on and have social contact, too bad those days seem to be history, at least for the present. Inez, thank you so much for the time. Good talking to you.
Thanks. Thank you.
All the best. Inez de la Quatera, the Washington correspondent for Global News. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.